I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. Today on the Friday News Wrap, we'll take a look back at a week of dramatic political news, from the Paul Manafort trial, to the arrest of a Republican congressman on corruption charges, to a special congressional election in Ohio that has given some Democrats hope for winning a majority in the House this November. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley joins us to make sense of it all. Then we'll hear how the city of Chicago is dealing with last week's spasm of gun violence. I'll talk with the Reverend Gregory Livingston, a prominent Chicago faith leader who's been active in protesting the violence and city leaders' response to it. And we'll close this hour with the Baltimore Business Journal's development reporter Melody Simmons, who will join me in the studio to talk about the Journal's new two-part series spotlighting the brighter side of Baltimore. The Friday News Wrap gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall this afternoon. Today, it's the Friday News Wrap, and we are going to start off with a look back at yet another extraordinary week in U.S. politics. Providing a kind of thematic backdrop for other political news this week was the bank fraud and tax evasion trial of Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chair. The trial went into its second week in Alexandria, Virginia, in the first courtroom test of special counsel Robert Mueller's prosecutorial chops. The Mueller team's case against Manafort, a criminal case which is unrelated to the Mueller probe of Russian interference in the 2016 election, included more dramatic testimony this week, detailing Manafort's alleged illegal and corrupt business dealings. Much of that testimony came from the government's star witness, Rick Gates, who was Manafort's former deputy in the Trump campaign, a longtime business associate, and a self-confessed partner in crime. Prosecutors have said that they plan to rest their case against Manafort today. While the Manafort trial has proceeded, there was plenty of other political drama unfolding across the country this week, and it is those other things that we will be talking about next, as we are joined by NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. He's on the line from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Scott, welcome to Midday.
Nathan, good to be with you.
And of course, we welcome your voice. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. This week started out on Sunday, as it so often does, with a presidential tweet. Trump again confirming that the Trump Tower meeting 2 years ago between his son-in-law, and then campaign chair Paul Manafort, and a Russian lawyer, among others, was indeed about getting dirt on Hillary Clinton. Scott, what does all that mean for the Mueller-Russia probe and anything else?
Well, it certainly signals that members of Trump's campaign team were working with Russians, Russian nationals, and Russian nationals ostensibly connected with the Russian government in order to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. That was not actually a new revelation. That was something that the president himself had said last summer, even though it was very much at odds with the initial explanation that had been offered with the Trump Tower meeting. Again, though, the president suggests that there's nothing wrong with that, others would have done the same, that seeking opposition research on your opponents is part of the political game. Seeking it from the Russian government might be something else again.
And as he says, collusion is not a crime?
That is the argument that both the president and his legal team have been making, although other legal experts have said, while there is no statute against collusion, there are statutes against conspiracy and unregistered foreign agents and that sort of thing. So there may be other statutes in play here. There has been kind of an evolution in the Trump legal team's explanations. First, it was, there were no meetings. Then, there might have been some meetings, but there was no law against that. And we'll see how that strategy evolves from here.
Later in the week, Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani said the White House had offered up some conditions under which the president would sit for an interview with Mueller in relation to the probe. What do we know about those?
What they want is some limitation on what the questions would concern. But there have been a number of legal experts, both inside and outside the White House team, who have said it would be malpractice to allow this president, who has a well-known penchant for stretching the truth, to testify in any kind of setting where he would perhaps fall into what Giuliani referred to as a perjury trap. The president has trouble keeping his facts straight, and to sit him down with FBI agents or members of the special counsel's team to give testimony would almost certainly be a legal jackpot for Donald Trump. So if he refuses to cooperate and refuses to testify, then we come to the question of, does the special counsel try to get a subpoena, and does that put us in a situation where you've got the courts having to wrestle with what is the obligation of a sitting president to comply with such a subpoena?
And it's unclear what that is, right?
It is unclear, and the courts are usually loath to get involved in what they see as essentially a political spat at that point. So we would be in uncharted waters, and it may be, as Donald Trump's team has argued, that Robert Mueller already has the information he needs from other sources to put together his findings, even if he doesn't get an interview with Donald Trump.
A tape of California Republican Devin Nunes came out this week in which he said that the Republican majority in the House, is essentially what he says, is what's protecting Trump from the Mueller investigation, and telling GOP donors that they need to keep the majority so they can keep on protecting Trump. Nunes did not know he was being taped, but it's not like this message isn't one that's already been going around in GOP circles. Do you think this is something that could be used more widely, publicly, as we head into the November elections?
Well, you mean by Republicans or by Democrats? You
know, by, I
mean,
both.
Right. I mean, there are certainly, you know, folks like, you know, millionaire contributor Tom Steyer, who've argued that impeachment is the reason Democrats should try to take the majority in the Congress. Republicans making a fairly cynical argument there that they are the only thing standing between the president and impeachment. I think there are factions in both parties that will see that as what's at stake in the midterm elections. There are lots of other things at stake in the midterm elections besides the fate of President Trump. Impeachment's a very extreme remedy. There are plenty of Democrats who also argue that, look, impeachment is not supposed to be an electoral do-over by other means. It's reserved for only the most heinous crimes. So, you know, not knowing yet what the findings of Robert Mueller are going to be and whether it climbs to that level, it's hard to say. It was certainly a cynical statement of Congressman Nunes to suggest that the reason people should vote Republican in the midterms is simply to protect the president from impeachment.
And I think that's also kind of funny, because even were the House to impeach the president, it would still have to go to the Senate for the conviction. And that's not even remotely likely, is it?
It seems like it'd be a big stretch. Again, not knowing what the findings of Robert Mueller are going to be, it's hard to speculate at this point. But that's a long way off.
A lot of the president's Twitter activity this week was endorsing candidates in Tuesday's elections and then declaring victory for the candidates that he backed afterwards, even when those candidates had not yet technically won. One of the big ones here, the special election in Ohio, where Trump's pick Troy Balderson was up by less than 1% over his Democratic opponent, Danny O'Connor. Trump had won that district by 11 points back in 2016. We still have to count provisional ballots to know what's actually going on. What's the takeaway here?
Well, Troy Balderson is in the lead, and, you know, Trump pulled out all the stops. He held a rally for Balderson last weekend, as the election was getting close. So he can certainly claim that Balderson is part of a winning streak for him.
But assuming he wins.
Assuming he wins, but of course, this is just a special election to cover the remainder of the current congressional term. Troy Balderson and Danny O'Connor are going to be going up against one another again in November to see who will be representing the district next year. But for the moment, the president can say, "Look, I pulled out a win," but it's certainly a tenuous win at this point, assuming the current results stand. And in a district that has been solidly Republican for decades, and which, as you say, the president himself carried in 2016 by 11 points. So it does tell you something about the landscape that Republicans are facing going into the November election, and the enthusiasm that Democrats have facing going into the November election. What we're really seeing is a shift in the suburbs. It was the suburbs around Columbus that seemed to tilt away from Republicans and towards Democrats. The rural vote continued to be strongly supportive of the Republicans, but the suburbs may be where the results come in November. And as a number of folks have pointed out, that district is far more Republican in its patterns than dozens of other districts. So if the Democrats can make a run for it in that Ohio district, there are dozens of other districts where they have that are currently held by Republicans, where Democrats will have even a better chance to pick off a seat, remembering they need fewer than two dozen seats to flip the House.
Another big race that's still not done, the Kansas governor's race, where Secretary of State Kris Kobach may have won against incumbent Jeff Coyler. Again, too close to call. Lots of issues there, right?
Right. And of course, one of the ironies there is that as Secretary of State, Kris Kobach is overseeing the balloting. Although after initially saying he would not recuse himself, I believe Kobach has now said he will stand aside. There was criticism from some county election supervisors that the Secretary of State's office was providing guidance in counting the votes that was at odds with Kansas law. Kobach's lead in that contest is now under 100 votes, so it does look as if there will be a recount in Kansas. And this is a kind of a case where it's not entirely clear which side Democrats will be rooting for. On the one hand, I think a lot of Democrats feel as if Kobach would be the more vulnerable Republican candidate in the general election. On the other hand, there's a lot of antipathy towards Kobach, and if he were to pull out the general election, he would then be the governor of Kansas, and that's not something Democrats would like to see. Kobach, of course, has been an advisor to the Trump administration. He was the spiritual leader of that short-lived commission on electoral integrity. He has been sort of the supporter of the president's claim that millions of votes were cast illegally in the 2016 election, claims which have not been supported by any sort of evidence. And of course, that electoral integrity commission was ultimately disbanded. But Kobach is a longtime stumper for more election security or voter suppression, depending on your point of view. And he's also a fierce critic of illegal immigration, which also aligns him with the Trump administration.
Another story this week with potential implications for November, the indictment and arrest of Congressman Chris Collins. He was charged with insider trading and lying to federal agents, and his reelection bid had been considered safe, but maybe not so much anymore?
That's right, although I think even with the indictment hanging over his head, Collins remains the favorite in that contest. The district we're talking about is suburban Buffalo, New York, and it's I think the most Republican district in New York State. Collins was the first member of Congress to endorse then-candidate Donald Trump back in 2016. And it's an interesting story here. He's a wealthy investor, and the charges against him revolve around his investment in a fairly obscure Australian biotech company. This first came to light in early 2017 when another then congressman, Tom Price, was up for confirmation as President Trump's first health secretary, and folks were scrutinizing Price's investment in that same biotech company. He had heard about it from Congressman Collins, and at the time the question was whether Collins and Price had somehow unfairly enriched themselves by buying into this stock and perhaps helping the company along in their role as congressman. Now, ironically, Collins is on the hook for trading involving the company's losses once its signature drug flunked a clinical trial. Collins is not thought to have sold any of his own shares, but the allegation in the indictment unsealed this week is that he shared insider information about that failed clinical trial with his son, Cameron, and that Cameron then passed the information along to others, all of whom traded on it and avoided big financial losses. So initially the question was whether Collins was enriching himself through the stock, and then it was whether his son and others avoided financial losses when the stock tumbled.
And maybe this won't end up messing with his reelection bid, but maybe it could have broader implications, the whole culture of corruption thing.
That's right. Democrats seized on the indictment against Chris Collins as another data point in their what they're calling the culture of corruption, and arguing that it's time to, quote unquote, drain the swamp in Washington by voting the Republicans out in their majority in the House. This is reminiscent of the campaign that Democrats waged successfully in 2006, when they again called for draining the swamp and talked about a culture of corruption. And of course, in that contest, Democrats did come back and take both the House and the Senate. We'll see if that taking a page from that old 2006 playbook works for them again.
Yeah, but it'll be difficult to use drain the swamp as a phrase, given that kind of has been co-opted elsewhere.
Exactly.
President Trump...
Although we did hear Sherry Bustos, one of the lawmakers who's part of the committee to elect Democrats in the fall, saying, you know, President Trump talked about draining the swamp, but instead of draining it, he built a hotel on it and pocketed more than $40 million in hotel profits last year.
President Trump has said that if he campaigns for or supports House and Senate candidates, they will win. He made that claim on Twitter this week. Do you think that's the case? And even if it is, there are, what, 435 House seats up for grabs plus the Senate. There's a lot of people.
There are. And, you know, Donald Trump is a polarizing figure, and he energizes people on both sides of the aisle. I think the conclusion that he has come to, and we'll see how different lawmakers in different environments decide to conduct their campaign, Trump's feeling is, look, Republican lawmakers are going to be saddled with my reputation whether I campaign for them or not. So I might as well at least go out and campaign for them so I energize the folks on my side. That is, the Democrats are going to be, you know, using opposition to President Trump to energize their voters whether he's out on the stump or not. So Republican candidates would be wise to at least have Trump in their corner cheering on their partisans. This is a similar argument that then President Obama made in 2014. A lot of Democratic candidates steered clear of President Obama, didn't want him out campaigning for them in 2014, and it may have cost them, because just like Trump today, you know, Obama turned off some Republican voters. That was going to happen anyway, and by not having him out campaigning aggressively, Democrats may have lost the opportunity to energize their own troops, and of course, they lost the majority that year.
One last piece of Twitter news from the president.
They lost the Senate majority, I should say. They lost the House majority 4 years earlier.
Right. One last piece of Twitter news from the president this morning, the announcement that the U.S. is going to double tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Turkey. What do we know about that, what that could mean for U.S. manufacturing, or even for fallout for the elections, given that the nation is already feeling some effects from tariffs that the Trump administration has been already putting in place?
Yeah, so the president has imposed more or less blanket tariffs on steel and aluminum imports of 25% for steel, 10% for aluminum. In the case of Turkey now, he's calling to double that, so 50% for steel, 20% for aluminum. Turkey is not a huge supplier of those metals to the U.S. In 2017, I think about just over 4% of imported steel in the U.S. came from Turkey. Less than 1% of aluminum came from Turkey. But what this does do is it increases escalates the sort of diplomatic spat with a key NATO ally. And this all seems to revolve around an American pastor, Andrew Brunson, who detained in Turkey. He's since been released, although he's still in Turkey. But the administration says he was unfairly, unjustly detained. Just last week, the administration sanctioned Turkey's justice and interior ministers in protest of the treatment of Pastor Brunson. So there's been a pretty interesting escalation of the diplomatic spat between the U.S. and Turkey over this one individual. And we'll see how that escalates. Again, I think the economic fallout, at least in this country, will be limited just because Turkey's not a huge metal supplier. But on the broader question of tariffs, that cuts both ways. There are Certainly, steel and aluminum workers in this country who welcome the protectionist help that they've gotten from the administration, but there are probably more numerous folks downstream who either work in industries that use steel or aluminum or who work in industries that have been targeted for retaliatory tariffs, and they're paying the price for the president's increasingly aggressive trade war.
Scott Horsley is a White House correspondent for National Public Radio, NPR. He joined us on the line this afternoon from NPR's Washington studios. Scott, thank you so much for being here.
Great to talk with you, Nathan.
We're going to be taking a short break now, and when we come back, we will shift our focus to Chicago, where residents are still reeling from last weekend's outburst of gun violence, in which around 70 people were shot, 12 fatally, in a single 48-hour period. We will be joined by the interim pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church in Chicago, the Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston, one of several outspoken faith leaders in the city who have been marching against the violence and against what they say is the city's dysfunctional political leadership. That conversation coming our way in a moment. I remind you that we always welcome your input. 410-662-8780, midday at WYPR.org, or via Twitter at midday WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall. Stick around. You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. A quick word about Monday's edition of the show. Tom's guest for the hour will be Rudolph Chow, director of the Baltimore City Department of Public Works. They'll be talking about the city's waste recycling and water and sewer infrastructure, fixing Baltimore's water billing system, and efforts to reduce the storm-driven sewage overflows that routinely contaminate the city's harbor and waterways. DPW Director Rudy Chow will be taking your questions and comments as well. That's on Monday, on Midday. Be sure to join us then. If you are just joining us now, this is the Friday News Wrap, and now we're going to take a closer look at the terrible violence that exploded in Chicago last weekend. Chicago is a city that has already seen more than 300 murders this year, and while that number is down compared to the last couple years, it's a number that communities, police, and government leaders are struggling to reduce farther. Obviously, this is a struggle familiar to people here in Baltimore. But even in a city like Chicago that's become somewhat accustomed to daily bloodletting, last weekend's spike of gun violence shocked the city. Chicago police say that around 70 people were shot between 6 p.m. on Friday and midnight on Sunday, and 12 of those victims died. The shootings were concentrated in four police districts on Chicago's south and west sides, typically more low-income and less well-developed areas of the city compared to the more affluent north side. Among the victims were a 17-year-old girl shot in the face and a 17-year-old boy on a bike. At a press conference Monday morning, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson, with Mayor Rahm Emanuel at his side, said more needs to be done to hold repeat gun offenders accountable. Here's Superintendent Johnson.
So I share the anger and frustration that many Chicagoans are having today. Because if anything, it should underscore the continuing issue that we have with illegal guns and offenders out on the street that are willing to use them. These shootings are not random. They are fueled by gang conflicts. We know who they are, and we continue to send a message that it's okay to commit these crimes by not doing anything as a community. I'm tired of it. Everybody in this city should be tired of it. The Chicago Police Department cannot do this alone.
There are too many guns on the street. Too many people with criminal records on the street, and there is a shortage of values about what is right, what is wrong, what is acceptable, what is condoned, and what is condemned. And we as a city, in every corner, have an accountability and a responsibility. If you know who did this, be a neighbor. Speak up. Neighbors come together. The city will be with you shoulder to shoulder. But this is not about alone, how many police, where were they? The superintendent will take accountability for that. This is not about how many summer jobs investment. We will do that, and we have more to do, much more to do. But there's something more at stake.
That was Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel following comments by Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson on Monday after a weekend in which around 70 people were shot and 12 killed during a chaotic 48-hour period. Joining us now is the Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston, the interim pastor at the New Hope Baptist Church in Chicago. He's a community of faith leader who has been organizing some of the recent rallies in Chicago to protest the violence and the city's handling of it. And he joins us on the line from the Fox News Chicago Bureau. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Really glad that you guys are allowing this platform such a serious matter. Thank you again.
You're welcome. Glad to have you here. What did you make of the police superintendent's and the mayor's comments about the violence last weekend?
Well, firstly, my condolences go out to all the families again. I've actually been working with a 17-year-old girl that was shot in the face, her family, Janae Patterson's family. It's a very sad and tragic thing, but it happens all too often. But one time is more is too often. I really felt what they had admitted, what they confessed to, is that they have no handle on the situation. They don't know what to do. And I feel that for Rahm Emanuel, the chickens have literally come home to roost, because he talks about neighbors talking to neighbors, yet and still, and I know we'll get into some of this, I guess, he's sitting on $500 million of HUD funding for low-income housing that can make some lives better for folk. When we were marching to Wrigley Field last week, I talked to some of the cops, and I said, look, you guys know there are people in this city that don't have toilets, running toilets. They still use buckets. They don't have heat in the wintertime or running water in the summertime. And for many people, they might say that's impossible. But what we're saying is that that's part of the situation, and Rahm destabilizing neighborhoods and these things. For him, the chickens have come home to roost.
One of the issues, of course, is guns, gun violence in Chicago. And Chicago has pretty strict gun laws. But, of course, many of these weapons are coming in from outside of the city. What can be done about that?
Well, gun laws are for law-abiding citizens, not criminals, right? But also, there's another population that exists. Chicago is intentionally segregated, and we're trying to intentionally desegregate Chicago in the Tale of Two Cities. But just like, back in the 20s, 30s, with the prohibition against alcohol, the prohibition created a new industry. It created an alternative economy. It created kingpins like Al Capone. And so when you have the South and West sides being insulated against the better off, North side and areas like that, what you do is that you have what happens is there is a prohibition of resources. And in this prohibition of resources and assets for these challenged and devastated areas, alternative and illegitimate economies pop up, okay? I'm going to get to your gun point. They pop up. People have the same human urge to have shelter, transportation, to do things for their loved ones. But because they don't have access, because of segregation, to the legitimate economies, they then grow the illegitimate economies. And the currency of the illegitimate economy is violence. And one of the tools of violence is the gun.
The currency of these economies is violence, you said, and the tool is the gun. I want you to talk a little bit about, for people here in Baltimore, the way that Chicago is segregated. Like Chicago, Baltimore is a town of many neighborhoods, but we have neighborhoods of different levels very close to each other. The richest neighborhoods are not that far from the poorest neighborhoods. We're close. How is the city set up that the North Side is so different from the South and the West?
Well, one of the reasons I chose August 2nd to do our Lakeshore Drive shutdown and the march to Wrigley Field is that August 5th, this past Sunday, was the 52nd anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's march through Marquette Park here in Chicago. And that march was hostile. It was nasty. And believe me, he didn't get sanctioned by then Mayor Richard J. Daley, nor was he strategizing with the police chief at that time. He was not sanctioned to be there, but from his love philosophies and all that, he was there to help the oppressed and the oppressors, right? But he was there because marching against restrictive covenants. And many people have seen the play and the movie Raisin in the Sun, but restrictive covenants were what white people signed, where they agreed that if they sold their homes, they would not sell it to a black person. And so that's one way to maintain the segregation and also to keep the land within the white construct, if I can use that language with you. So King says Chicago is the most segregated city. After all my work through the South, this is the most segregated city in the country. And so this you talk about the north side, the south side, the west side. You know, when I was a kid, Nate, I was scared to go downtown. My parents are from the south. They're deceased now. But they never came as far north as I did, you know, as we did last week. And because, you know, the devastation, the challenges are generationally perpetuated, there were many people that were with us on last Thursday who had never been to that part of town. And you say, how is it like that? It was the Chicago with our 50 aldermen. We have 50 aldermanic wards. We're not as big as New York or Los Angeles, but we have more aldermanic ward city councilmen than either of them, you see. And so these things have happened year after year after year. If you remember, Harold Washington ran for mayor, was the Democratic choice, but for the first time in memory, a Republican unknown named Bernie Epton ran against him, a close race. And then when Harold gets into office, the city council divides up by race, 29 white aldermen versus Harold's 21. So it is something, it is a damning historical legacy, but one that we still fight against.
I was fortunate enough to visit Chicago last month, and even though I know that your city is very large compared to Baltimore, you're the third largest in the nation, I didn't really understand how big until I got there. A lot of people, in response to the weekend violence, have been pointing to the per capita murder rate of Chicago, which is not super high compared to some places, not even in the top 20 for big American cities. Baltimore's is worse than that. Last year, your city had about twice as many homicides as we did. But in population terms, Chicago's like 4.5 times bigger. But these per capita murder rates don't really mean much to the families who've lost loved ones to violence. And also, if these murders are being concentrated in very small portions or not as large portions of the city, I guess it's a far higher per capita murder rate in the South Side, in the West Side.
Right. I mean, you know, there's some actuarial magic that goes on. Because, you know, there can be numbers, but there are spikes in other areas. And also, in areas that were heretofore thought to be super safe, there's also been, you know, violence creeping into those areas. And we talk about blue-on-black violence, black-on-black violence, but any violence, white-on-black, white-on-white, all of it's not good for the city if we are to be one city. And I'll say this to you as well. When it comes to Chicago and why I believe that we stand out when it comes to violence, even if there are per capita differences, it is because, you know, the most famous gangster in the whole white world is not John Gotti. It is Al Capone. And Al Capone basically became an American folk hero in some ways, an icon. And so before they started calling us Chirac, if you travel to other places and you mention Chicago, people who didn't speak English would go, all right, tat, 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 imitating a Tommy gun and talking about, you know, Al Capone, the Untouchables, and all that. So that is part of what
cultural,
allows
perhaps.
Our
cultural?
Situation to be magnified, because it is rooted in such incredible violence and history.
What do the people who are in the neighborhoods that aren't seeing this violence think? Do they even, you said you want this to be a full city, as of course we in Baltimore want it to be an integrated city, or at least I do. What do the people who are not in these neighborhoods feel? Do they see themselves as in a different city? Do they not care?
Well, you know, segregation does a couple of things, insulation and desperation. To those that are allowed the assets and things of that nature, they're insulated from what the desperate are doing. You know, it's almost, we started calling Rahm hashtag Rahm Antoinette. You know, the people have no bread. Well, let them eat bullets of lead, you know. And so that's why we marched up north on beautiful Lakeshore Drive up to fabulous, you know, iconic Wrigley Field, because we needed to redistribute the pain, the anguish, and the dormant hope. When people talk about protest fatigue, they don't understand something. It might be fatigue to the people who are witnessing it, but for the people who are desperate, it is not protest fatigue. It is saying, look, we're trying to wake up our brothers and sisters. And for you all to say, when they were looking down from us from Wrigley Field, they were wrapped around the stadium. It was incredible. And I don't think I saw not one black face. That's not a condemnation. I'm just telling you what I saw. And I wanted them to say to themselves, why would these folk come up here, march through here, do all this? There must be something going on. What is it in them? And maybe everyone didn't think that, but you don't need everyone to make a change. You just need a few committed people.
What do you think needs to be done? What can be done? You mentioned the $500 million for housing that you have. What can be done with that to help remedy this?
Well, you know, again, Rahm has been sitting on $500 million of HUD funds for most of his administration, but he has a $1 billion TIF/slush fund where he hands out money to his developer cronies. What can be done are a couple of things. You know, we cannot continue to talk about the violence in Chicago if we ignore the corrupt tree that produces it. And I understand that Rahm and Superintendent Eddie Johnson did not start the corruption in Chicago, which breeds violence, but we cannot allow them to perpetuate it. And what you see now is an overreaction to last weekend's violence. Things they should have been doing before that they weren't doing. Can I tell you my hound dog story real quick, Nate?
Yeah.
Can I call you Nate? Is that okay?
You can call me whatever you'd like, sir.
You got it. My folk are from Arkansas. I was born in Chicago, though. Granddaddy had a hound dog, and they're sitting on the porch, you know, granddaddy and his buddy. And so the hound dog is lying there just crying and whining. And his buddy says, "Why is that dog whining like that?" And my granddaddy says, "Because he's lying on a nail." And his friend says, "Why doesn't he move?" He said, "Because it doesn't hurt bad enough yet." Human nature is such, biology teaches us that mutation requires irritation. Human nature, sometimes people just won't do, it's in them to do, but they just won't do until they become irritated or uncomfortable, you know, in order to get it done, to remove that irritation or that discomfort. We went up north to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable because we know it's in them, and a lot of folk would like to do, but they just don't know how. And I got to tell you, I've been getting responses from white suburbanites, white Northsiders and the like that want to get involved with our next action because they know that we have to change something. One of the things is we need Rahm out of office. Resign, quit, whatever it is, choke him out. We need him out of office. We need a police superintendent that is hired legitimately. Eddie Johnson was illegitimately hired. His hiring was an example of Chicago corruption. There was $500,000, Nathan, spent on a national search for a new police superintendent. And so we got three. They were rigorously vetted, and they were known as law enforcement executives who were reformers. Rahm did not want a reformer in that position pushing back against him. So what he did is that he suspended the law for one day, thereby flushing the taxpayers' $500,000 down the toilet, suspended it for one day, and appointed a man who neither applied for the job or ever showed any interest in the job. And Eddie Johnson, understand, Eddie and I attended the same grammar school and high school. This is not easy, but we have our big boy pants on, Nathan. So when Eddie said after he got in, "I never saw discrimination on the Chicago Police Department," I was like, "Eddie, what are you talking about? You send officers to racial sensitivity training." And that's when I really realized that now not only do we have a mayor without a heart, but we have a superintendent without a spine.
And I suppose that marches and organizations will continue to make that figurative nail be a little bit more noticeable and maybe make some change.
Yes, we must now conduct, whether it be in a series or however we do it, massive actions. And when Dr. King, when they did the Montgomery bus boycott back in December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks was arrested, one person. Well, everybody didn't stay off the buses the first 2 weeks or the first couple of months. But 385 days later, December 20th, 1956, they had bankrupted the Montgomery Bus Company. And so we must, those of us that can, that are committed, that understand this, that understand that we need one city, because if one part of the city is injured and diseased and we ignore it, the city is like a body. The other systems and parts of the body would be affected as well. And for the people that are not aware of that, that still doesn't excuse us for doing what we have to do, whether they know the good of it or not.
Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston is the interim pastor at the New Hope Baptist Church. Thank you for joining us on Midday.
Thank you, Nathan. It was a pleasure.
Another short break, and when we're back, a new series of articles just published by the Baltimore Business Journal tells readers to look on the bright side when it comes to Charm City's future. One of the series' lead writers, real estate and development reporter Melody Simmons, joins us next. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. Online readers of the Baltimore Business Journal were invited yesterday to take a fresh look at the city of Baltimore through the prism of a new series of articles by Journal reporters. BBJ editors say unabashedly that the series is intended to accentuate the positive about a city that is so often framed in terms of rising crime, poverty, and political dysfunction. The series called Stop Apologizing, Baltimore. It's a two-part series. The second part will be published next week, and it's being made available outside the Journal's online paywall, that is, without charge to non-subscribers. And the Journal is hoping that that wider exposure will help drive a public conversation about positive trends in the city. Here to talk about the series is Melody Simmons, real estate and development reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal and author of the cover story for part one in the series, a piece with the provocative headline, What Could Baltimore Do If It Got Out of Its Own Way? Welcome, Melody.
Thank you, Nathan.
What could we do if we got out of our own way?
I think the city could communicate better. I think what we found in months of reporting, talking with dozens of people, is that everybody has something to say about Baltimore at this point in time, but not everybody is speaking with the same voice or on the same page, which is pretty common, I think, in a city. But with Baltimore and all the troubles that it's had over the past 3 to 5 years, it's so crucial right now to have some kind of a reset and have everybody have some more common thinking about how to move the city forward.
I think so often people in Baltimore are conflicted. We have two opinions of the city at the same time, at the same, you know, just sort of held in our minds, the good and the bad. This is why we love Charm City. This is why we maybe don't. And this series is aimed at tilting the lever towards the former.
Well, yes, indeed. I think that what we, when we sat down as a staff and talked about it, we realized that there are so many great qualities about this city. And the city has taken a punch in the gut. And so what we set out to do was to talk to as many people in as many places as we could. And that would be elected officials, business people, everyday people on the street, advocates, business owners, small and large. Just talking to them about what they feel that Baltimore could do right now to promote itself in a better light, something that would help the city lift out of its image problem.
Share some of the takeaways that you've been getting from people so far.
Well, a lot of people have said that they really love the city, but they find that it's troubled. And the crime issue, you can't get away from it. This was the same answer that everybody got all the time. So there's a great fear of crime and safety. And I know the mayor is looking into it and has a task force. There's meetings every day during the week at City Hall. But I think that the head lines defy some of the data that we're hearing coming out of City Hall. So there's a disconnect there.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the mayor sometimes goes on the stump or goes out and talks about how the crime rate is dropping. Yet you get the Monday headlines that there were 10, 12 shootings over the weekend. So this is very disturbing to the people who live here and do business here and want to do business here and lease and, bring in a new workforce.
Yeah. And you found that that is, or potentially is, an obstacle to bringing in a new workforce to Baltimore. The people may be scared of the crime and the violence that they hear about before they come here. But once they get here, they see what we see about the city and how wonderful it is.
Right. We're hearing that, too. The image outside of Baltimore, I talked to Kirby Fowler, who's head of the Downtown Partnership. He told me he went to a conference in Berlin, Germany, mm-hmm. Earlier in the summer, and told some of the other economic development people that he was meeting with that he was from Baltimore. And they made a face and said, oh, that city. And so here it is on the international stage as well. So the city's image has taken a big hit. And what we were trying to do with this series was just kind of get out and talk to people and figure out what we could do in reporting just by talking to people to see what some solutions might be.
Can you share some of the anecdotal stories you heard while you were reporting this piece?
Well, we heard a lot of stories from people. I'm turning the page. I brought the series in here. We talked to a lot of people who were saying that there are some some leasing, some businesses that are bringing more employees in. We found that some of the neighborhoods, such as the Northeast, where we both live,
yes,
are really on the rise.
Oh, and I loved that story about the nameless NPR reporter.
Yes, yes.
Would you like to tell that?
Well, Annie Milley, who is head of Live Baltimore, this is out of, the reporter came out of D.C.
Yeah, this is NPR National, not us.
That's correct. That is correct. Came to Baltimore, and she interceded and put him in her car and basically drove him around the Northeast, took him to Lauraville, to Hamilton, to Mayfield, by Walther Gardens. The snowball stand was closed, by the way, but nevertheless.
It's open evenings.
It's open evenings. Evenings and it's popular. And so really showed him on a guided tour one-on-one about some of the areas in the city that we know about as residents, yet the an outsider, someone who lives down in Montgomery County, which is where this reporter lives, was not aware of.
And it's so easy to have a monolithic perception of the city if you're not from here.
Right. And the headlines aren't great. USA Today put out a story calling Baltimore one of the most, or the most violent city in the country. I know that's interesting considering Chicago, just your prior interview.
Per capita versus numbers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of other good headlines that the city has managed to be a part of as well.
That's right. That's right. And the New York Times, we say in this story here that depending on who you talk to and depending on what you're reading, you're going to see the city in different lights. And I think that describes Baltimore perfectly.
We are many different lights.
I believe so.
Any other stories from the first part?
Well, we spoke with a lot of... We spoke with a lot of everyday people. I was out in my car driving around, which is what reporters like to do, and I came upon this street over in East Baltimore, and there were some shells, which we see all the time, these vacant row houses, and there were some workers there. I parked the car and got out and started talking to them. Turns out an investor had gone and purchased three of them and had gutted them completely, and believe me, I mean gutted, because there was nothing salvageable except the...
Taking out the trees that may have been growing inside.
Taking out the tree, yes, the famous Baltimore tree. And so was basically converting them into a luxury row house. And these, I got the developer on the phone, and he said he hoped to sell them for a minimum of $260,000 apiece. And this is after purchasing them for somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000. So it was a big flip.
Oh, and as I forget who, but in one of the articles said, Baltimore is a city that was built for 1 million people, and we've lost 300,000 of those. There's a lot of opportunities.
Right.
If we can refurbish what we got.
Right. There's a lot of opportunities. And I think what we're seeing with the population drop is that this has impacted the tax base a lot. And in order to generate the growth in the city leaders have voted to give tax breaks and have voted to give all kinds of incentives for certain development. And that is taken away from the tax base as well. So the city has taken a double whammy hit in that way over the past, say, 10 or 15 years.
What's yet to come in the series?
Well, we have another segment next week. It will launch, I believe, online on Thursday. And what we're going to see is some of the local neighborhoods. We had some reporters go out into some of these neighborhoods all over town and talk to business owners, residents, community activists about Baltimore, the highs and the lows. So we have more voices coming.
Mel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Melody Simmons is the real estate and development reporter with the Baltimore Business Journal, which this week published the first of its two-part series focusing on the brighter side of Baltimore. It's called Stop Apologizing Baltimore, and it's not behind the paywall. After you have read these stories, the Journal is hoping that you'll want to be part of a larger conversation about Charm City's future. They'll be hosting a public forum to discuss the series on August 28th, that's a Tuesday, on the second floor of 36 South Charles Street Coffee. Starting at 8 a.m., the discussion will be led by BBJ editors and reporters. The talk will include prominent local leaders and business people and a chance for audience members to ask questions and share their ideas. And we have more information on how to register for this free event on our website, wypr.org/midday, or you can contact April House at ahouse@bizjournals.com. That is it for us today. Coming up Monday on Midday, Tom Hall will be back to host a full hour of conversation with Rudolph Chow, director of the Baltimore City Department of Public Works, and they will be talking about what's in store for the city's waste management and water sewage systems and taking your questions and comments. We hope you'll join us for that coming up Monday on Midday. And thanks to Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses, inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online ordering at bottomsupbagels.com. I'm Nathan Sterner. Tom Hall will be back in the host chair on Monday. I'll be back in the morning edition chair Monday. Hope you'll join me then. Thank you for listening. And have a great weekend.